In the nanotechnological world, the big buzz out there right now is about nanotubes. And one of the reasons why, I believe, is we discussed the space. Remember the space elevator? You get in at ground level, you push the button, and you virtually go into, well, you go to 22,300 miles up to a geostationary, well, I presume, space station, something like that. It would be the other end of an elevator, like an elevator in a building. Now, this traditionally, though thought to be possible, wasn't really possible because we didn't have anything that was strong enough. But now I'm told that these nanotubes would make some kind of material strong enough to actually build something from ground Earth all the way to a satellite in geosynchronous orbit. Professor, welcome back. So therefore, we should have a good understanding of what nanotubes potentially are. They don't exist yet, do they?
Tubes do exist, and in great abundance in art. They seem to go back at least until man set off that first controlled chemical reaction, chain reaction, called fire. When you heat things up in a fire in a cave, you get soot on the roof. The carbon atoms come apart and they reform.
Right.
And there's no doubt, probabilistically speaking, that there were carbon nanotubes in that soot as there is in the soot of your chimney.
Well, okay, what's a nanotube?
Nano first means 1/1000th of a meter, whereas micro is 1/1000th. So we're down to level, really, of individual molecules or things made of atoms. And a nanotube, the classical ones now, they've been around for about 10 years, the carbon nanotubes, they look like a piece of chicken wire that's been rolled up into a cylinder. But bear with me on this.
Okay.
How you arrange those carbon atoms, in this case in hexagonal form, like a stop sign, and makes a big difference. If you arrange them in a different way, you get a diamond structure, for example.
Okay.
They're basically sheets of graphite, the first ones, rolled up. And as you said, they're extremely strong, can be quite long. I believe it was Arthur C. Clarke's novel, Fountains of Paradise, that postulated and expanded upon the space elevator. And in there, there was a wire a guy was whipping around, a nanowire, that cut off his own thumb, and he could never see the wire. In theory, that could happen. And in practice, so far, it has not. But nanotubes are around in great abundance. Every major university is pursuing it, and companies, there are several patents filed on this recently. A couple companies have announced a prototype nano memory chip, and you'll see much more of them. But they have remarkable properties in terms of their strength and their ability to conduct electricity. And it's really that ability to conduct electricity and to change their state from metal to semiconductor or to fuzzy states in between that makes them the device of choice in modern nanotechnology. There's been a lot of talk art about nanotech for a long time, and it's starting to come through now. This is the first real workhorse. Now, whether it pans out, it remains to be seen, but it's as hot as it gets.
Okay, I still don't know what a nanotube is. I mean, I heard you, I guess, describe it, but I don't really understand what it is. I understand it, nano, okay, extremely small, in the billionths, you said.
Right.
But I'm not clear on what the material itself actually is.
Again, it's carbon atoms, the classical ones. Now there are non-carbon nanotubes made of boron and a variety of other materials. That may be the way it ends up, the inorganic approach. But they're rolled up in a cylinder, and that's about 100,000th the thickness of a human hair, for example. So very tiny. They can be quite long. And their length can affect how they process information. Their diameter can affect that, whether they're in a spiral, all those shapes. And wonderful mathematical properties determine whether it'll behave like a metal or a semiconductor, so it could do computing purposes.
So you're suggesting on software orders, it could morph virtually?
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that. And so it can become different things. The same mass of nanotubes could become virtually different things.
It could. That's a tougher proposition, but by controlling how you create these things, you can get different things. We're not at the level where we can take one tube and change the molecular structure to get a different type of tube. In other words, you've either got a metallic tube or you've got a semiconducting tube. And that may very well change in precisely the way in which you say that we shoot it with a little bit of electrical energy or a light pulse, and it transforms. And that's getting at the heart of the old dream of nanotechnology and really of the ancient Greeks, and that is to master matter.
How far might we be from, let's back away from the space elevator for a moment and just assume that nanotubes begin to produce an extremely strong material, stronger than steel, stronger than, would it be lightweight? Would you make airplanes and jet fighters out of it, that kind of thing?
Great question. There's many proposed usages. For example, we might have automobile skins that are nanotube-like, in which case when you have an accident, you're more likely to bounce off the other guy than to have a crushing deformation. On the other hand, you might bounce a lot longer because of the elastic nature of the collision.
Huh.
There are patents and prototypes underway for nanotube-based screens for your computer and for billboard signs, perhaps. They seem to compare favorably in theory with liquid crystal displays for flat panels, things like that. Yes, they could be light. On the other hand, there was an attempt to use them for bulletproof vests, and they couldn't really, the carbon tubes, stand up well to the impact of a bullet. The tubes fractured and created little nano diamonds.
When shot?
When shot. Those are carbon tubes.
These things then already have been, at least experimentally, applied to applications like that.
Art, the gold rush is on.
Gold rush, wow. So the new gold rush isn't like
maybe a diamond rush would be a better way to put it.
Yeah. Let me get this straight. Carbon, when compressed, becomes what? Eventually a diamond, right?
If you have it in the form of a certain kind of tetrahedron, which is like a triangle, it'll be a diamond. You put it in the form of a soccer ball.
And that's the shape they had it in the attempt at the vest.
Well, just a second. The soccer ball gives you the so-called buckyball after the Buckminster fullerene.
Right.
That's 60 carbon atoms. It's very stable. And you can also put more than 60 or fewer. It's just not as stable, and you get different kinds of properties. But if you have linked soccer balls, you in effect get a tube. That's kind of what you get. Now, if that pattern is like a stop sign to the carbon atoms and a hexagonal pattern, six-sided pattern, that's graphite or graphene, and that's our working carbon nanotube. But in the end, it is some kind of simple crystalline structure like that that's repeated even in the non-carbon cases. And as you said, it's extremely strong and long. And if you were to weave these into a nanotube braid, there's no telling the strength. I mean, there is. Mathematically, we haven't fully worked that out. And we're just at the cusp of this, just at the very beginning.
How does its conductive ability compare to traditional conductors like copper, silver, or gold?
It tends to be better in terms of heat, and at that small level, it's more controllable. This is why, I mean, as you know, we have a great Nature magazine called it Crisis of Computation facing us. We keep shrinking our chips. We've got to keep doing it. It keeps the march of technology marching, but we can't keep going much further. In most of our lifetimes, we will see this transition somehow from the microprocessor to the nanoprocessor. When you'll know that, by the way, Art, when they change the name from Microsoft to Nanosoft. That will be the big tip-off.
I wonder how far are we from that, Professor? We're moving along at a pretty doggone fast clip, I must say, with computer technology right now. And everybody wonders. You know, they're getting smaller. They're getting faster. Then all of a sudden they make a breakthrough, and what was really hot running at 2 gigs is now suddenly not so hot at 3 gigs. They did something magical, and so, you know, how long?
Great question, and no one can of course, foresee that the result of that great technology race, but so far the leading horse in that race is the nanotube. I see the announcement recently of nano chips, prototype chips, from Nantero is a company, N-A-N-T-E-R-O, and I have no affiliation with them. They claim, as recently reported in Business Week, for example, that they'll have a prototype out next year, and along with some other companies with whom they have patents or assigned patents, they expect to have some mass-produced tube-based chips by 2005, and they allege that the memory chips will be cheaper than a penny. Now, these will be the first and very crude things, and it's often the case in technology that those who make the great fortunes come along later.
Yes.
But there, you know, if you went to the patent office here or in Japan, you'd see an awful lot of filings based on nanotubes. And you know, whatever comes next, this attempt to directly program matter, not just software, but matter itself by assembling and playing with the structure of atoms, or the collections of those in molecules. And I have to boast like a proud parent, Art.
Please do.
That this week, my colleagues and I have published, and it's available on my website, which is available at your website, a brand new paper on nanotechnology, and the first ever on that I'm aware of on a formal use of these tubes for signal processing. In fact, we call that nanosignal processing, stochastic resonance in carbon nanotubes that detect signals. So we've gone further here, I believe, and we've shown how to use a tube, not just as a lot of people are, as a kind of transistor, it's either on or off for a bit of information, but to actually detect the presence or absence of signals. And many researchers are growing forests of tubes, or growing carpets of tubes are called, or arrays. So in a small square inch, say, there could be trillions of tubes. Now, the trouble right now is most of the tubes, they come out all tangled up. It's very hard to untangle, but that's a technology problem that will probably get straightened out. So you could have a shirt, for example, that could do vast signal processing. You might throw it away, too, and it could have literally trillions of tubes on there. It could be used in a variety of other places, in wireless communication to help in the replacement of a severed limb, for example, in terms of the complex neural signals in a nerve bundle, ultimately, say, in the spine. There's just so many signals being propagated there, and in theory, these bound or these collections of tubes could do that. Recently, there was a report.
You're saying that these tubes could potentially repair a broken spine.
They could be part of that. Now, of course, there's a delicate issue there of the circuitry, making sure the left foot connects to the right foot and or the right knee and so forth. That's possible if you can work that out. The trouble now, any of these kind of devices, is first off, the body is pretty tough on inserted devices, and there's just so many nerve fibers that you'd have to connect. But assuming you can do that and sort that out, and again, that's a technology question we're going to hit, that in theory you could build a bridge with nanotubes or their successors. But there's a recent report on creating hydrophobic tubes. If you coat the tips of a bunch of tubes with Teflon or something like it, you get a self-cleaning surface. You put water on other things and it repels it. There's all sorts of things here that are being explored. But it's interesting that by changing the thickness of a tube and some very simple parameters, you can turn the tube into a metal or a non-metal and grow it accordingly. So as you can imagine, the patent race, the technology race is a gold rush.
Okay. I'm still stuck back on the manufacturing process. How do you make a lot of nanotubes? What is the process you use to actually create these?
There's a lot of them. The classic is soot. A Japanese researcher found some soot and looked at it under a microscope in effect and found you need an atomic microscope, found these tubes. So there are those kinds of approaches. There are sparking approaches, arc lamp type approaches. There are gas-based methods where carbon gas is injected and a variety of chemical operations are done on it.
How economically feasible is the process to create the end result?
Right now it's not real feasible, but it's a lot better than it was a year ago. And so, in terms of looking 5-10 years, unless something turns out that they're just too difficult to control and program, and they may be, but that doesn't seem to be the issue. Like you said, that one problem, Art, is it's easy to make these things, but it's hard to often unmake them. An example is something called a nanotube tweezer. You can take two nanotubes, hit it with a little voltage, a little electrical juice, and they'll pick something up. Something much bigger than they are, by the way, very strong. The trouble is, it's hard to get them to let go. Haven't quite figured that out yet. But
what do you mean? What do you mean? It picks up something? Give me an example. What do you mean it picks up something?
Well, in effect, like a little speck of dust or something, something vastly bigger than the tubes, and it can grab. You can get it to close on that and manipulate it, but unfortunately, as I understand where we are right now, they haven't found an efficient way to get it to let go. There's all sorts of physical bonding principles that kick in at that point.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sure.
That's a potential big problem.
Lots of problems, but that's what researchers do. They love problems. Those are manageable problems. If you have a problem, Art, that requires going faster than the speed of light, now that's a dead end, but there's nothing like that here. And it'd be different, too, if there were some other viable alternative. Now, the big debate, there's always a big debate in the field, the big debate is whether we should work with carbon tubes, the classical tubes, or whether we should work with the non-carbon varieties. And there's a variety of these coming out, different chemical alloys and mixtures. And the finding so far is that in terms of conducting electricity, nothing can top the good old carbon tube. But the other properties, like deformation and turning into nano diamonds when shot, it may be better in that case to work with a non-carbon approach. And the field is wide open, and the patent office is the recipient.
And which way do you think it shall go?
the history of a lot of chemical research, I remember I'm an electrical engineer, I work largely with information processing, so I'm on the outside of this, but seems to favor inorganic processing over organic. It's much tougher to work with fleshy carbon-based things often than non-carbon. So my money would be on the non-carbon. In the paper I mentioned, we use carbon nanotubes, but the property of the tube we use doesn't depend on the carbon nature of the material. It applies for any tube.
So you're saying we're that close, just short years before practical application?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, several large companies have patents and whole foundries underway. Samsung has a prototype it's working on this liquid crystal display. It may be we just don't know. It may be the way to really have an efficient and expensive high definition TV screen.
Huh.
So that's in hand, or your cell phone may...
Figures. I just bought a high-definition TV this week, so I'm sure it will be totally out of date. But plasma will be like the VIC-20 by next week.
Maybe not next week, but within 5 or 10 years, let's hope so.
You go out and buy the latest nano set.
That's right.
I wonder if do you think that name, by the way, will stick to most products that get developed from this technology, a nano this, a nano that?
Given the evidence of the success of the word micro,
that's
micro devices,
yeah.
Microsoft.
That's true.
First order, I would say yes.
That's true. All of that stuck, so why not? What would be the properties, if you know, Professor, for example, of a screen? I understand a little bit about plasma and how LCDs work and all the rest of it. If you had a nano screen, what kind of properties would it exhibit compared to, say, what we have now? Potentially, would it be...
The three big ones that are touted,
yes,
on the prototype. First, less power usage. Remember, we're a world that's sucking up more power all the time.
Yeah, that's
a
big one.
The black house. That's an issue.
Yep.
Second, more brightness, brighter stuff. So you could more likely to see that advertising screen, say, in bright daylight. You know, it's kind of hard to walk outside with your computer now.
That's true.
And finally, wider viewing angles, the allegation. Now, I haven't seen that demonstrated, but that's the claim of the researchers out of Samsung and elsewhere. But they have the physics and the chemistry on their side.
Boy, so, you wonder what people in these big companies like Samsung and Sony
IBM
and Hitachi, all of them, and what they're doing deep in their research labs. And you're telling me this is what they're doing.
Correct. And you can check that. Look at my paper. And go to the American Chemical Society's journal, Nano Letters. It's available online. And for example, our paper will appear in print in a few weeks and will kind of be old news by then. And at that point, they give it out for free. But you could just scroll down and look at what's hot this week, and they list those articles. And look at the institutions behind this. They're not all American.
Well, just to cheer me up a little, some of them are, right?
Absolutely.
Good. I worry that the Japanese, in fact the Chinese, soon to come, leap in front of us in some of these areas, and of course they have in the past.
Art, my paper has four authors, and my other three co-authors are Chinese. I have to be careful how I answer that.
Really?
It is still they're Chinese Americans. It is still largely an American-driven game, and Europe's in there a big way, and Japan and other...
Well, I know, but we frequently seem to do the inventing,
right.
Professor. As the cold rain falls here in the desert, it is indeed raining right now. Our guest is Professor Bart Kosko, and we're talking about the little things. And Professor Galana of New York City fast blasts me the following. A friend insists that mandatory IDM implants are 18 months away. I don't agree. What do you think, Art? What does your guest think? I believe this has something to do with nanotechnology. Thanks. Okay, well, it's sort of a... Here's a good political what if for you, Professor. And right now, things are already bad. Buildings destroyed in New York, the Pentagon, 9/11, the whole mess. And we are horrendously concerned with security in America. And one more major incident, like 9/11, God forbid, would probably drive quite a bit over the edge. And in one of the areas where we might go over the edge in security would be with ID implants. I believe that technology exists right now. And do you suppose that we could be driven to something like that? And if the government were to come to you right now and say, we need that, could it be provided?
Could be provided. And I think you're onto something big here, Art. In some sense, the great, terrible achievement of Osama bin Laden was he got us to do something that most people can't. He got us to effectively amend the U.S. Constitution. And
that's
if it happens again, and
that's
unfortunately the odds are that it will,
yes,
there's no telling. But the ID tags of one sort in terms, at least of a microprocessor, that's relatively routinely put in dogs at the pound so far, a little grain of rice-like thing.
Right.
I don't think it'll be mandatory, but I do think something like that will help in a natural voluntary process. A lot of our devices are so shrunken down, the signal processing devices, and processors are so cheap that when you buy a gadget, they're going to be communicating, in effect, with some other database, and someone will have track. You will leave digital footprints all over, not just cyberspace, but your house and elsewhere. And forget the government, just a hostile party or neighbor or interested corporation can track you, and certainly the government could, and it will become admissible evidence in time in courts. And if should there be some extreme attack, some kind of nano weapon, and unfortunately that could happen too, yes, I think the balance between liberty and security will tilt increasingly to security, and that means adios to the Fourth Amendment and provisions of the Fifth, Sixth, and Eighth.
Well, they're already wounded. They have a lot of scars around them right now, so yeah, I don't disagree. You just said nano weapon. What kind of... because if the big corporations are working on nanotechnology for soon applications, you know, in televisions or whatever, well, then our government, what are they doing in their labs? Let's see. Gee, I bet they're working on nano weapons. What kind of application might there be? Imagine a nano weapon for me.
I did. In fact, it's in my book, Nano Time. And that was a book where some folks went to get rid of oil in favor of hydrogen. So they've produced a version of what we today have, what we call superacids, things that are billions of times more corrosive, say, than sulfuric acid. And it's released, for example, an oil tanker. It is a chain reaction, and within 5 minutes, you got a 5-million-gallon puddle of oil off the coast of Florida or Los Angeles or where the case may be, because it eats certain things and doesn't eat others. In this case, didn't eat the oil, ate everything around it. And the real trouble with this, Art, that's so unfortunate, is that it's so much easier to destroy than build. And that's really the heart of the second law of thermodynamics, the increase in entropy. And so, yes, we can assemble molecules, in theory, with a lot of effort, but it's very clear, I think, that it's going to be a lot easier to take them apart. If we don't care about the order, we just want to disassemble things, reduce them to goo, as it's often called.
Goo, yes.
Then you've got a real potential for catastrophe, because you could have something that feeds off its own energy, like fire does, like a nuclear reaction,
right?
A nano reaction that could do that. And I'm almost hesitant to say more. It's just sort of thing you want a lot of smart people around the world thinking about, but unfortunately...
Consider this. If the government came to you as the expert you are and said, we want you to work on such a weapon for us, would you?
No.
You would not?
No, I wouldn't.
When I read your bio, it does seem as though you've had some related type work. Let's see, you worked on smart weapon systems like the Tomahawk.
I did indeed. So you asked a general question, but if you asked a real specific one, if there was some kind of ticking clock between disaster and some great public necessity, sure we'd all do what we could. But in general, to, for example, go to the government and say, give me some money so I can do some research on this, or to get an increase in salary, I think that would be immoral and dangerous. No, I wouldn't do that.
So if they came to you and they said, we want you to work on a nano weapon that would eat with a voracious appetite, which would be a horrible, destructive thing, you know, this gray goo we talk about, or some variant of it, perhaps a more specific goo that would just eat...
A smart goo, because it eats only certain things and not others.
Yeah, exactly. Like a goo that, let's say, eats,
DNA flesh.
No, I was going to say Chinese, but I'm not because of your associations.
Art, my wife is Chinese, too.
Mine's a mixture. Iraqis. You know, it doesn't matter. You know that we're in some horrible.
I think the only way you could morally do this, Art, would be as a defensive measure, the fighting fire with fire. If the only reasonable way to stop the spread of their likely nano goo is with a counter goo, then you got to work on it. But to be the first one to pop that cork and look what happened with the nuclear weapon and the Cold War and how we almost came.
Well, if I were in the government, Professor, I would come to you and I'd say, Professor Cosco, we have a goo gap. So-and-so is developing goo, and oh my God, we need a defense or we're history. Because anybody who will crash an airplane into buildings in New York will surely release this in 2 seconds flat if they've got it. So I would convince you, and you would go to work on it at that point.
This is a horrible theorem from game theory, but you're right. It's a consequence of what's called the prisoner's dilemma. It's a terrible thing, and it leads to an arms race or a goo gap race here. Yeah. Well, so what you don't want to do, Art, if you possibly can, is start that process. Will it happen? Unfortunately, it probably will. Again, because it's a lot easier to cut down a tree than it is to grow one. And it's a lot easier to just not worry about how you disassemble particles or molecules than to try to put them in very careful Lego-like shapes.
Well, we got the atomic bomb before we got reactors capable of producing electricity, right?
Right.
Yeah. So probably this work is, would it be a safe guess to say it's going on?
I would say it's a safe guess in the sense that we researchers and world worried about terrorism have to be worried about this kind of thing. As I said, if you want to go to the American Chemical Society's journal Nano Letters, just
right.
click on it, and right. there it is, publicly available. If you're sufficiently smart and dedicated, there's no telling what great things you could do or what terrible things you could do with that information. And when we're at the forefront like this, or we're not thinking about these consequences. We're thinking about surviving peer review and getting published. And so we do keep pushing that frontier forward. And inevitably, in some unforeseen way, we will very likely be pushing this. And other people have to be thinking about that, trying to anticipate it. In the course of it, they may come up with a great result.
All right, switch of subject here a little bit. When we discuss neural networks that will eventually be put together, no doubt with nanotechnology, and we're talking about Are we possibly talking about what we would regard as a sentient machine, not understanding, frankly, what the human brain is? I mean, we're conscious of our own existence. We have a consciousness.
And
but
that's true.
At some point, there's this little tiny area where, gee, if you make a machine well enough, you might run smack into the wall of consciousness and go past a certain point, and the machine says, I am.
It could, and I think the word consciousness is such a fuzzy term. For example, we spend about a third of our time sleeping. We don't really know what's going on there. We have a lot of good theories, but we just don't know what's going on. And so if we replicate the function of individual neurons, for example, a nanotube can do that. In our experiment, the nanotube is acting like an antenna, and a field of these can process all kind of information. But in others, and related to ours too, they act like transistors or on-off switches, just like
yes.
Any of those 100 billion neurons in your brain do or throughout your body. It's hard to believe you couldn't replicate a lot of those processes. And that seems to be summed up, Art, in a sense of pattern recognition, that we view our brains as pattern processors. Our life is filled with that. The awakening from childhood and recognizing your parents' face and the very structure of the world, the color red for the first time, and as Plato said, from the red wagon, the red apple, and we get these generalized notions of redness, even though we've really never seen redness, we think we know what that is.
But, I mean, I guess the question is there any reason in the world why a machine could not eventually attain consciousness?
Not if we say consciousness is what the brain excretes in its 100 billion neurons. If we can replicate those neurons, even simulate those in mass, then it follows that we're simulating its byproducts, one of which seems to be what we call consciousness. Now, whether we had built into it, Art, a will to power and to replicate genes and things like that, it's another matter. But on that sheer issue of whether it can have whatever that confederated anarchy is, often put, of different neural networks competing with each other to recognize a pattern and focus attention, which is a very key part of that, yes, and we have really tiny examples of that now. We're not up to the level of a fly yet, but it's a matter of scale.
If we were to get to the point that we did create a consciousness, then are there not dangers that we would not be in fully in control ourselves, no matter our instructions?
Right.
Once you cross a certain threshold, it may be that human instructions might be judged
a waste of time,
immoral, impractical, illogical, judgment made by a machine.
And this gets back to that very first point about the question you asked me, would you say yes, would you release information? My
yes.
answer was yes, because of the nature of efficient markets. And in effect, the brain works like a market of neural networks. And if you extend that to some kind of super smart machine, which is inevitable, just hooking together enough of the future computational devices, it may well see so many things that we don't see. It would say, in effect, if you folks knew what I or it knows, you would never walk in this direction. So in good faith, since I am programmed or my ultimate commandment is to look out for your well-being, the answer is no, kind of thing. I could easily imagine that. And that would be, in effect, having created not a child, but a super parent.
Do you have any clues about what breakthrough might walk right up to that barrier of consciousness, to that magical instant? How much storage, how much speed in a processor might equal consciousness?
I think, you know, we know that the brain uses about a fourth of its processing for vision.
So I've heard, well, and only what, a tenth of our entire brain or something?
Something like that.
Yeah.
But an awful lot of those neurons and all those wires and that gray mass is devoted to that. When we have implants, initially for the blind, and then just for failing eyes as you age, that are comparable to the eye.
Yes.
Not there yet, but we will definitely get there someday.
Sure.
At that point, that kind of processing, you'd have to wonder what would be the effect of other implants and whether the collection of those implants don't themselves represent at least the brain and something, or the mind and beyond it. So that would, to me, would be the litmus test. Do you have something that's comparable to the eye? I mean, it's a remarkable thing, Art, that you're looking at something. I'm looking at a can of 7-Up now. If I move my head, the whole frame of vision doesn't move. It's somehow held fixed in that so-called binocular vision. That's real tough to replicate, and there's literally thousands of researchers doing it in hundreds of proposed ways, and a lot of them fail simply because they can't process the bits fast enough. But when we get there, some of these algorithms, probably most of them, will do what our eyes do and do things that we can't do, as well as, of course, see in different modes of the electromagnetic spectrum that we can't see in.
At the present, let me try and restructure the question. At the present rate of development in the chip industry, nanotechnology, and all the rest of it, at the present rate of development, which seems incredibly fast, if you project 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years out, I mean, at some point, just projecting from where we are now and how fast we're going and advancing exponentially, you can take a guess at
yes,
when, yeah.
And I'll give you what we call in statistics a confidence interval.
Okay.
With 95% confidence, it'll be plus or minus 5 years, plus or minus a year, 2020. So between 2015 and 2025,
yes,
we will almost surely have crossed a lot of barriers from the microprocessor to the nanoprocessor and a lot of other messy problems associated with that. Really learning how to do science and do engineering information processing at the level of molecules, and it'll be inexpensive and powerful. Somewhere in there, that's a big enough interval that I am 95% confident that you'll see powerful implants that were comparable to what it took nature really hundreds of millions of years to deliver up by blind chance. Evolution.
Isn't that creation?
It's a form of creation. It's a form of getting information ultimately out of that wonderful stream of photons that we get for free from the sun. That seems to be the driving force.
So one might only have to live another 20 years or so to get to that point. And if you don't, do you recommend cryogenic suspension?
Cryonic suspension. I, as one of the members of the science advisory board of the largest cryonic outfit, Alcor, that seems to me maybe not the best way to go, but so far the only way to do, just to keep your brain intact at some point, because most of us probably won't make it, at least to the point where computer replacements are efficient and inexpensive. It'll take a while, and why not do time in a bottle rather than the alternative?
I believe you told me you've opted for it, haven't you?
I'm an all-body patient.
That's right. You're going to have everything frozen.
All-body. Just for sentimental reasons, I want to have all those parts. May have to hang the carcass on the wall like a stuffed creature, but I'd like to take it all with me.
When you discuss this with your family, what sort of reaction do you get?
Well, my daughter grew up always hearing it from me, so she thought it was quite natural, as do most young people, Art, thanks to Austin Powers and the power of television. But the older generation is quite uncomfortable with it. It's an expensive and obscene form of burial, perhaps, and worse. And it's often seen as anti-religious, and that's just not logically right. I mean, you can be just as religious whether or not you go into the tank and you get up, and I would suspect you know a lot more about first causes if you wait a while and find out what science has to say about that in 100 years or 1,000 years.
Are you really satisfied intellectually, Professor, that being frozen in such manner would sufficiently preserve you, excuse the term, freezer burn, you know, and whatever all else might go on in that process, to actually have your consciousness revived intact? Do you really believe that, or what are the odds?
The odds, maybe not at this moment, are very good, but the crucial point is that the tissue, once suspended, whatever damage it incurs through the icing process, they're always working to improve that, it doesn't decay. Whether you have to wait 5 seconds or 5 centuries when you're frozen, you can afford to do so. And so you're gambling against future science. Is it reasonable to assume that in 10, 50, 100, 500 years, we'll be able to, with a nanotech-type technology, resurrect you a molecule at a time, a cell at a time? Today, absolutely not. But there's a non-trivial probability of that right now, and that is only going to grow in time. Unfortunately, the first ones frozen will probably be the last ones thawed and repaired. It'll be so hard to do it.
Sure.
But given the options, it's a relatively small investment in terms of what a typical funeral costs, if you amortize that out.
Yeah.
And if you just look at the odds of the alternative, like I said, it's really the only game in town. It's not the best game, but the only game. And after all, Art, you're only talking about betting on your corpse, not on your life.
Boy, all right.